Okay. I'm beginning to notice a number of international students. Is there a preference to do the course in English? That's one yes, more yeses. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Some of you I know, of course. Okay, we can put it to a vote. Who would agree to having the course in English? That's everybody except one, right? Is there anybody who doesn't speak German? Half a person. Okay. All right, that sort of leaves it on the edge, right? Okay, one point to add to that. The course material will remain in German because it currently is in German and I'm not maintaining two versions of the material. So, under that proviso, who would agree to having the course in German? Nobody. Oh. Sorry, no.
No, that was very wrong.
So, under that proviso, the material being in German, who would agree to the lectures being in English? Okay, so that is now a sort of semi-unanimous vote. Okay, let's try this. It will carry the slight problem that, well, the material is in German, I'm reading off the material, right? So, bear with me. As some of you may have noticed, the sheet's been online since this morning. Okay, one thing to notice is the hand-in date, so that's 2 weeks from now. Currently, you're not able to solve any of the exercises that are on the sheet, but I'm hoping to cover most of the necessary material today and the rest on Monday. So 2 weeks from now is like 11 days from Monday, which I guess should be enough time to solve it because it's also not excessively hard. I'll show it to you now, although you don't yet know some of the keywords, just to basically raise flags when the words that are on the sheet actually crop up in the lecture. Right? So there's an exercise on currying in number one. Well, I mean, any of you who knows about functional programming will of course know this, but we're nevertheless gonna make it explicit one more time. Then there's a number of exercises in number two on just a particular format of recursive definitions that we're hopefully going to see either today or on Monday, specifically the fold format. Then there's one example of an inductive proof for functions that are defined in terms of fold, will be defined in terms of fold in the lecture, so defining them. So this basically, this is the map function on list, we just call it list instead of map. So this will be seen in the lecture, defining it is not part of the exercise. And then there's an exercise at the end that is slightly more substantial, where you're asked to actually define a data type of trees of a certain shape, then come up with the, two laws of the general nature that we're going to see in the lecture, as I said, either now on Monday. And to use the, generic induction principle, if you will, that you get from this data type to prove a very simple equation. Okay. Where did I switch this off? Yeah. Okay. So the first session last week was a basic recap of, well, things to know about sets and functions. And, well, we're going to delve a bit deeper into, well, certain functions that are going to be important in the course, and which in particular we're going to want to generalize later to, well, when we think about categories other than sets. So basically, we're going to look at some important functions, or actually types of functions. So one operator on functions that we talked about last time is composition of functions, which we wrote in applicative form, so f compose with g means execute g first, then f. And we have this notation for the function space. X arrow y denotes the set of all functions from a set x into another set y. And first thing to note is that under this notation, we can write the composition operator itself as a map. Call this comp to be definite. We'll occasionally use it. And well, it takes two arguments. Actually, it's, do we want this order? Okay, to stay consistent with what currently is there, I'll actually keep the order of arguments. So the order of arguments of the map that I'm now going to write down is actually diagrammatic. So it's opposite to this one here, right? You can see that in the types. So the arguments are one function of type A to B and another function of type B to C. And of course, what we can do is compose them to get a function of type A to C. So basically, this thing is given by mapping a pair G, F to F composed with G. Right, okay, so that's one thing that's going to show up in some diagrams later. Then the next group of functions revolves around Cartesian products. Some of them have shown up in theory of programming already. So we already recalled last time what the Cartesian product A times B is. It's the set of all pairs whose first component comes from A and whose second component comes from B. And this thing comes with two so-called projections. These are two maps into A and B, respectively, which we write out left and out right. And then it may happen that we have a third set C, and two very similar maps going into A and B, respectively, say F and G. And then, from this pair of maps, we get a unique map that we call angle brackets F comma G, or just the pair of F and G. which goes from C to A times B, and that makes this diagram here commute. That is, I'll make this explicit for once to explain what the phrase "the diagram commutes" means. I'm not normally going to keep doing that. So that the diagram commutes means it never matters which way I take, which path I take from one node in it to another. So if there are several ones, they basically yield the same result. So here in this case, for instance, I get one path from C to A, which is just F, and one path which takes the detour via A times B, and those yield the same result. So this here is the one that takes the detour, and this equals F, and then there's another pair of parallel paths, that's this triangle here. So outright composed with F, G equals G. Okay, and basically, again, I'm claiming that a unique function with these properties exists. I'm actually going to prove that. So, existence. Well, I'm just going to define the function. So I have to say what the function does on a typical element of its domain. So I have to say what f, g of C is. And I'm going to decree that f, g of C is the pair f of C, g of C. Just as we did in theory of programming, basically. Okay, now I've defined it. Now, of course, I have to check that it really does the job. So I have to check that when I have to check this equation here. It's an equality of functions, so I have to check that it gives me the same result on all inputs. So I take the left-hand side, apply it to a typical element of its domain. That's, again, C, so I'll call the element little c. Well, let me just calculate what this is. So first I, for once, so I'm being slow at the moment. Things will be quicker later on. So I'll first expand the definition of the composition operator. So that just means I apply out left to the result of applying angle brackets FG to C. Okay, this here I have defined, so I can just unfold the definition. So this is out left of the pair F, C and G, C. Well, let us make the definition of out left explicit. So out left of a pair A, B is of course A, and out right of a pair A, B is B. Okay, if I plug this in here, then I see that out left of this pair equals F of C. Okay, now I've shown that for every input, this function here gives me the same result as that one, so the two functions are equal. And of course, this equality is shown in precisely the same way. So that's existence. Well, actually, to avoid having things hidden, I'll just continue here. So I'm now going to show uniqueness. So how does this work? Well, I assume a competitor, and I show that it's equal to the one that I already have. suppose that I have some map H from C to A times B. Such that out left composed with H equals F, and out right composed with H equals G. Okay, let's be explicit about what we want to show. We want to show that this thing here equals the function f, g that we've already seen. And again, we check this by providing both sides with some input from the domain, which is again C, and showing that the result that we get is the same. So the slight problem is that I now need access to the two components of the result of H. So I'm going to give them names. So the result of applying H to C is a pair A, B. We have to show that this pair equals the result of applying f, g to h, so that means we have to show that a equals f of c and b equals g of c, and just for explanation, once I've shown that, I would have shown that the pair A, B is the image of C under the map angle brackets F, G. Okay, now I will have to use another blackboard after all, but never mind. Okay, so how do I do this? Well, according to the definition of out left, A is out left of A, B, which is out left of H of C. Okay, I'm really going to be very slow, so I'm actually going to recognize the definition of the function composition here. So this is out left composed with H applied to C. And now our assumption about H kicks in, namely that out left composed with H equals F. So this is F of C. And that's what we have to show. And of course, symmetrically for B. So, done, right? So there is exactly one map with these properties. I'm going to give this thing a name. We have color. This sort of property is called a universal property. And they're going to show up again and again. That's why I'm being so pedantic about it. Okay, so what actually has the universal property? Well, this pair of maps here has the universal property. The universal property of being a pair of maps into A and B. So every other pair of maps into A and B factors through uniquely. And we can exploit universal properties like this for the time being in a very simple manner. just make some sort of dash here to indicate this is the next item in our list of important things. So, assume that we have two totally unrelated functions, say one function f from a to b, and one function g from c to d. Well, we can now form the Cartesian products of the domains and the codomains. So we have a times c up here, b times d down here. We have the right projections. Well, they're both called out R, but of course they are different maps, right? And the left projections. Okay, now what do we see? We see a pair of maps into B and D, respectively, that starts here. Where? Well, we have F composed with out left here, and we have G composed with out right on the other side. And now we can exploit the universal property to get a map here. Again, it exists uniquely, making the diagram commute, and we call it F times G. This map, too, we have already seen in theory of programming. Okay, we can wonder briefly what it does, right? So let's just follow what happens on the right-hand side. F times G. Well, stop. So let's look at the right component. That means let's look at the right-hand projection of the element of the result that we get by applying F times G to a typical element of its domain. So a pair of the form A, C. Well, by commutation of the diagram, so from now on I won't introduce the composition operator in between, but just skip over this, right? So I can swap the application of these two maps and get first G, then out, right? So this is G of out right of A, C. Well, an out right of A, C we know, right? So this is G of A. And of course, we can perform a similar calculation for the left projection. So,
G of C, right?
G of C, of course, yeah, thanks. Right hand, yeah. So, what comes out is F times G of A, C equals F of A, G of C. Nothing very exciting, to be sure. We could have defined the map directly, of course. But it is worth noting already now that we can get it from just the universal property. Although, yeah, I mean, in sets, we can define everything directly, no problem at all, right? But in other categories, this may be less straightforward. Okay. Next. Now, the first thing that you will find on the sheet, so seeing this will enable you to solve exercise one on the sheet. We have a map that we will call Curry, in honor of Haskell B. Curry, whose first name is indeed the origin of the name of the programming language Haskell. So what does this function do? Well, it takes a function with two arguments, something from A times B to C, and it turns it into a function that returns another function that still expects an argument. So basically, when we write a function with two arguments in Haskell, we will write it in this style to begin with, right? So this is the type of a two-argument function in Haskell, or in fact, in any functional programming language. Okay, so what does this do? Well, curry will consume a function, a binary function. So we have to say what curry of f is. Okay, curry of f is again a function. So if we want to say what this function is, we have to say what comes out when we plug in some argument. So we have to say what curry of f of a is. Okay, curry of f of a is going to be a function from b to c. So in order to say what that is, we will again have to apply it to a typical argument. So curry, we have to say what curry of f of a of b is. Well, that's now easy. We just apply the original f to the pair a comma b that it will accept as an argument. If we just want to say what curry of f is, then, in one line, using formal notation only, then we need lambda calculus, right? So who remembers enough lambda calculus from theory of programming to tell me the term? Yes? The names don't matter. Yeah, well, A, yes. Yeah. Right. So this is, of course, a highly confusing notation that, it's perfectly correct notation, right? What one has to realize, this looks like nothing happens at all, right? I have a function with two arguments that returns f of a comma b. But of course, in lambda calculus, this is actually an abbreviation for two lambdas in a row. So this here is really notation for exactly what we get on the right-hand side, a function that takes an argument A and returns another function which takes an argument B and then returns f of A comma B. Right. And in fact, this curry function can also be seen as coming from a universal property, namely this. We have something that's called the evaluation function. Let's give this a name in blue. So this is a function that takes two arguments, one function from B to C, and an argument, or a possible argument to that function, that is an element of B. And it does nothing more intelligent than just to apply the function that it gets to the second argument. So it goes to C, and it takes the pair f, b to the value of f on input B. Okay. I'm tempted to do this by erasing in this diagram, but that'll be a mess. No, not to save chalk, but to show the analogy, but yeah, won't work. So let's draw this thing into a diagram. So we have this evaluation map up here. And now let's just write down a similar thing. Of course, the word similar is very underdefined right now. Namely, a map from something of the form anything times B to C. Say F. And we find that, again, there exists a unique map. Well, I cannot quite draw it into the diagram because that would give you the wrong idea of uniqueness. So there exists a unique map without the B, such that if I take this times identity, then the whole diagram commutes. And this function is curry of F. Okay, for the time being, I will not bother with the actual uniqueness proof, which is also easy. I'll just show that the diagram commutes. So let's calculate this. So I take the evaluation function and apply it to curry of F times identity of a typical argument. So a typical argument will be a pair in A times B, so A comma B. Okay, what is this? Well, we've seen what this times operation does, right? So this here will apply the left-hand function to the left-hand argument and the right-hand function to the right-hand argument. So this is f of curry of f of A. And in the second component, I apply the identity to B, so I just get B. And I also know what the evaluation function does, right? So it applies the left-hand argument to the right-hand one. So what I get is curry of F of A of B. And this I can just look up because it's still up here, right? So what comes out is F of A comma B. So I've proved my claim. The proof of uniqueness is very similar, so we can also easily see that this function has to behave in exactly that way if the diagram commutes. Okay. Right, so that's our brief summary of sets and maps, or actually construction of sets and the associated maps that we find in the world, basically. Okay, now to our actual first topic, data types. So I'm going to wipe the front blackboard, and I'll wait till everybody has copied this. Everybody done? Fine. So that's going to be our topic for some time from now on, data types. We've already seen data types in theory of programming, but we're going to treat them slightly differently now. Well, moderately differently. Okay, most people will know what's typically called simple data types, so this is not me being derogatory about these types, it's just the standard name for them. Like the Booleans. Okay, and any self-respecting programming language will actually be able to define the Booleans as some sort of enumeration type, right? So in Haskell, for instance, except I would have to write the equality sign slightly differently, and I would probably have to capitalize the constructors. It would probably look like this. So bool has two values, true and false. And if I have enough time and nothing else to do, I can define the characters, which are say have 128 values, which I see as the bottom half of the ASCII alphabet. And I can write down slightly more complex types, which correspond to variously structures or unions in C. And I'm going to write them Haskell style again. So for instance, I can define a type either which contains things that may be either Booleans, and are in this case labeled with the constructor bool, or characters, which are then labeled with the constructor character, little. So I'm capitalizing types and writing constructors in lowercase here, so Haskell wouldn't accept this, but never mind. Okay. Or I could define what would correspond to a struct in C, something that collects data of different types in one value. For instance, something that will in every value contain a Boolean and a character. So I have one constructor, let's call it tuple, that takes two values, one of type Boolean and one of type character. Okay, one effect of declarations like this is that they will define the constructors as maps. Right? So what we get is, for instance, the constructor bool here, which takes a boolean and returns something of type either. Or here we define tuple, which takes two arguments. So its domain is boolean times character, and it goes to both. Right. Okay, and then there's two twists that the whole thing can have, and which are regularly exploited in functional programming languages, but don't typically appear in imperative languages such as C. One of them is parameterization. So maybe the absolutely simplest case of this type is the maybe type that we find in Haskell. This takes a type argument. Let's write it as a capital letter and also use brackets, not entirely standardly. Okay, so maybe of A should be a type that, well, either contains a value of, or whether values either contain a value of type A or they don't. So, a value of type maybe of A could be either nothing or it could be an element of A which I wrap into a constructor just. So now, just is not a single map, but actually more like a family of maps. I get one constructor just for every set A, or type A. So just goes from A to maybe A for any A that I deign to think of. For instance, I can instantiate this to the booleans, so I get just as a map from booleans to maybe of bool. Also, recursive parameterized data types. Okay, what does it mean for a type to be recursive? Well, what it always means for things to be recursive, namely, the thing that I'm defining will appear in its own definition. So, basic example of this type are the natural numbers, probably the single easiest recursive data type. So what's a natural number? Well, a natural number is either zero or it's the successor of a natural number. So what do we get from this in terms of constructors? Well, we have talked last time about how we don't really need to distinguish between constants or elements of a type and maps from one into that type. So zero can be seen as a map from the singleton set into nut, and the successor function is just a function from the naturals into themselves. Okay. Now, of course, I've defined the naturals as just by some equation, so I haven't really fully said yet what they are. And well, we're not going to make this precise later, but for the moment we're just going to say, okay, we're looking for the smallest solution of that equation. So we're looking for the smallest set or type that is closed under these operations, right? So or the least. So the natural numbers are the least set that is closed under these operations 0 and successor, that is, I'm not going to make explicit what it means to be closed under these operations, well, this thing here is outside the recursion, so I just take it as a fixed type that is taken for granted, basically, so I apply 0 to the inhabitant of it and expect to end up in the natural numbers. And for all things x, if x is in the natural numbers, then suck of x is in the natural numbers. Where, and this is the important bit, I understand the application of these functions as something purely syntactic. So this here is not really application of a function that does anything, I just write down the constructor, as I would in Haskell. So nothing happens when I write down a constructor, except that the constructor appears somewhere. Okay. Okay, and in fact, we're going to look at this type of natural numbers in more detail, and we're going to recall the fold principle that we've seen in theory of programming. Okay, so the fold principle basically defines functions from certain parameters. And in the case of the natural numbers, there are two of these parameters. There are always as many parameters as the data type has constructors, so in this case, two. And the parameters have basically the same typing as the constructors of the data type. So in this case, well, it's good to see them. In this case, okay, we're going to basically define one competitor to the data type, something that behaves like the data type, except it isn't the data type. So this thing is going to be called capital C for the moment. So what do we need? Well, we need something to match the zero, so an element of C. And we need something to match the successor, so in this case, an endo function on C. So now we're going to define the fold function for the naturals, which for clarity I'm going to call fold n. In most contexts that you find, it will just be called fold. And it takes these two arguments, well, parameters, let's say, C and H, and then delivers a function from the naturals into C. And slightly abusively, I'm just going to define this recursively. I mean, that's cheating, of course. I mean, this is just because we're still basically at the example stage, right? So later on, recursion is actually going to be defined from fold. Right now, I define fold by recursion, so that's really the wrong way around. That's an emoticon. Okay, recursively by what? Well, recursively means, in the easiest case, that I just have two cases, one for each of my constructors. So I have one case for zero and one case for successor. So I have to say what fold n ch of 0 is. Well, there's not really that much I can do. I have to deliver an element of C not having any element already in hand. The only one that I can really think of offhand is C. Well, of course, I could apply H some arbitrary number of times to it, but I won't. So fold n of CH of 0 is just C. I will, to save on brackets, I will occasionally switch to lambda calculus slash functional programming notation, where I omit brackets in function application, right? So it's clear what this means, right? So this is the application of fold n ch to 0. Okay, and now for the other constructor, that's the successor. So, okay, I'll stick to correct bracketing, which in this notation now demands that I put the successor of n expression in brackets, because otherwise it would try to apply fold n ch to the successor function as an argument, which won't work for typing reasons. And it's also semantically bogus. Okay, so what does this do? Now I use recursion, right? So I assume that I have already defined fold n ch for n. Right, so this thing I already know. That's my recursive call. And to this thing I apply, well, not successor, but h. Okay. Right, for this simple data type, I can actually tell you in sort of closed form what fold n does, if you're willing to accept some, if we're willing to work with the three dots, right? So well, that's because we have this very simple format of the inhabitants of our data type. So the only type of things that we can write down is, well, first we can write down 0, and then we can apply the successor constructor some number of times to it, including 0. So this is the most general form of an element of the natural numbers. And okay, we see what fold n does, right? So it replaces this 0 by C, and it replaces every application of successor by a call to H. So what this boils down to is h to the n of c, so which just means h of, no, brackets, dots, brackets. Okay, so which just means I apply h n times in succession to c, so this here is meant to be n copies of h.
Now, for the n of ch of n is a function and not c.
Well, H is from C to C. This here should be an element of C, hopefully. Right, so fold n of CH goes from the naturals to C. So applying it to N gives me an element of C. And applying H to that element gives me an element of C again. Right. Okay, so this is what the fold operation does. In general, it's not that easily written down, because when data types become tree-shaped, then there's no simple form like that in which I could write the typical element on the blackboard. But nevertheless, we see what happens, right? So a fold will just run through a term and replace the constructors that it sees by the functions that I prescribe, or at the leaves by the constants that I prescribe. In this case, only one constant, only one function. Okay. Examples. So I want to define the function is zero with the obvious meaning as a function from the naturals to the booleans. So how do I write this as a fold? False end. Yeah, well, false end is constantly false, right? So, right. So is zero equals fold n of, okay, right, now comes the case zero. Well, for zero, I want true, right? So evidently, I'm going to have to write true. And for the successor case, well, as soon as something's a successor of anything, it's not zero, right? So in this case, I always want false. So we have previously written this as false bang. Now that we know lambda calculus, of course, we can write false bang as lambda n dot false, right? Okay, so that's our first very easy example. Morally not at all recursive, by the way. Second, so what's our second example? Remind me. Plus. So let's do something easy. Plus m, so that's addition of some fixed number m to the argument. So this is now just a function from the naturals to the naturals. So how do I write this as a fold? M.
Yes.
Yes. M. Yeah. Right.
And the second one, identity.
So what happens when I do this? What does the function do?
Yeah. When I apply in the zero case, it returns M.
Yes.
And in all other cases, it just returns. I have to apply suck. Yeah. Okay. It's wrong. Yeah.
Right, so I apply successor, right? Yeah. So I apply successor as many times as specified by the second argument, right? So that gives me exactly, I mean, if the second argument is n, or let's say k, if the second argument is k, then applying successor k times 2m will exactly give me k plus m, right? Okay. Yeah, that's sort of boring, right? So, okay, we can define plus, but only for a fixed argument on one side. So, where do we go with this? So of course, what we would like to do is just define plus, right? So what's plus? Well, plus is a function from the natural numbers times themselves to the natural numbers, a binary function on the natural numbers. I can't define this as a fold. Why not? Right, yeah, for basic type reasons of typing, right? It doesn't type. I mean, yeah, a fold of anything takes one natural number, not two. So we know how to fix this, right? How do we fix it? Yeah.
Curry.
We curry, right? So. So curry of plus now goes from the natural numbers to the function space from the natural numbers into themselves. And of course, given our notation, we know what we can write down what curry plus does, namely, it maps m to the function plus m. Okay, but that's not how we want to do it. So, what's curry of plus in terms of fold? The second bit is slightly complicated, so let's start with the left argument. Yep.
Plus zero.
Plus zero, yeah, and what is plus zero? Yeah, well, yes, that's true, too, yeah. But, I mean, as a function, if you think about the function plus zero, what does it do?
Yeah, it adds a natural number to zero.
And the result is?
Yeah, the natural number.
So, which function is this, then?
Just
it's the identity, right? So, we apply. So, first thing, the constant, basically, is the identity. So let's first describe informally what should the second function do.
Well,
So the second function is an endo function on this space here, right? So it takes a function, just a second, it takes a function from the naturals to the naturals and returns a function from the naturals to the naturals. Suggestion. Plus of one. So plus of one is which function?
Plus one.
Well, successor, right? So yeah, right. So basically, this is the function that takes a function on the natural number and composes it with suck on the left, actually. Right. So in lambda notation, this is lambda f dot. Suck composed with f. Okay, now we haven't introduced lambda notation, so we have to think about briefly. Think briefly about how we write this in our current notation. Basically, of course, as a function, we're not really committed to an actual programming language, so it would be fine to write it like this. So what is this? This here applies the composition operation to a pair of things, right? Namely, successor on f, of course, the other way around. So this here is f of, well, since the order is the other way around, f of f and suck. And comp, not f. So this is comp of f and suck. And if we want to write it in a point-free style, then this thing here is comp composed with a pairing function, namely, this thing comes from the function type natural numbers to natural numbers. So the argument is this here. So on the left-hand side, we just get the original argument as the argument of this thing. So on the left-hand, we just have identity. And on the right-hand side, we always have the successor function regardless of the input. So this here is effectively a constant function. So this here is suck bang. So this is then our right-hand side of the definition. Okay, so that's how we define plus. So let's make the types of this thing here explicit. So if we call this thing here H, then this is the profile of H, right? And down here, we have a slightly complicated type in between. So we have pairs of functions on the naturals, and we have the composition function that just composes these two to get a single function on the naturals. And here, we have a pairing function where we pair identity and successor bang. Right. Okay, now for the sake of completeness, we write down the expression for plus itself using a function that appears on the sheet, right? So plus itself can be written in point-free style as just uncurry of the expression that we had for curry of plus. So basically uncurry just reverts the effect of curry. Uncurry of fold n of identity and the pair. No, not the pair. And comp composed with the pair identity comma suck bang bracket bracket. So we're getting there, right? So the title of the course isn't entirely unjustified. So what we see here is algebra of programming. We write down programs just as closed expressions of some form. Note in particular that no recursive call can be seen here, right? So the recursion is all hidden in this fold operator. So basically, we turn recursion into an algebraic operation, if you will. So that's the philosophy that is in particular being followed in the book from which we stole the title of the course, Algebra of Programming. So they really do this to very great detail. Okay, now, two things that, so basically we have two very important properties of fold, and these are recurrent in the sense that we can define fold operations for all data types, and in all the data types we get these two proof rules that I'm going to show, or actually one of them is just an equation and one is a rule. So, the first, well, not rule, but actually equality, or axiom, regards the identity. So basically, how do I program the identity? And, well, it's fairly obvious, right? Well, if I want to program the identity as a fold, well, what the fold does is it walks through the term and replaces the constructors by something that I provide. Well, if I don't want to change anything, then the thing that I provide to replace the constructors with should be the constructors, right? So identity is just fold n of 0, suck. Okay. I'm not just going to claim this and sort of say that it's plausible, I'm also actually going to prove it in a moment. And then, we have fusion, which is a rule rather than an axiom. So it requires something that we already know a few properties of, namely well, basically what the rule is going to do it's going to relate two folds, two different folds. One of them for functions living on C and one of them for functions living on C prime. And we want to relate these two by a map K, which is compatible with the, well, not the constructors, but with the maps corresponding to the constructors that I have on both of these types. So, one of them is going to be the thing that corresponds to zero. So this is an element C on of C and an element C prime on the other side. And K should just map C to C prime. And then we have a function h here and a function h prime there. And k should also be compatible with those. So k composed with h should be the same as h prime composed with k. Let's draw this as a diagram. We have h here as a map from C to C. And h prime is a map from c prime to c prime. And at the top and bottom, we have k, and this diagram here should commute. So that's my assumption. That's why I'm calling it a rule rather than an axiom, because it basically makes an equational assumption. And now comes the conclusion of the rule. Then k is also compatible with the corresponding folds. That is, k composed with fold n of what? C and H gives me fold N of C prime and H prime. And let's draw this as a diagram. So we have the natural numbers in the upper left corner. We have this map fold N of C and H, which goes into C. And we have fold N of C prime and H prime, which goes into C prime. No, there's something wrong here. No, there's not. And we have this map K, which goes from C to C prime, and this diagram commutes. So basically, if this holds and this diagram commutes, then this diagram commutes. Intuitively, this is sort of unmysterious, right? So if we remember what fold N does, right? It basically takes a natural number and then replaces the 0 by C and every occurrence of successor by an H. And if I then apply K to this, well, I have the K in the beginning, then lots of H's, and then a C. Well, then I can commute the K through the first H and get H prime according to this equation here. I can keep doing that, commute the K through all the H's and convert them into H primes, right? So this is then H prime of H prime K C. And then I also have this equality here, so this is H prime up to H prime and C prime. So shouldn't be a surprise, basically. But nevertheless, one should and can actually prove this formally. Okay. Oh, but we're out of time. Why doesn't anybody say anything? Okay, so I'm going to prove this formally next time. No, wait, stop. No, we have 10 minutes. Come on. No, we'll start late, right? So, I mean, not late, but to the later point in time that we agreed upon. So, the proof of both these principles, well, basically in both cases, I claim equality of functions on the natural numbers. So I'm just going to prove that by induction, good old induction. So let's start with the identity law. So remember, in inductive proofs, I have to show that, well, in traditional inductive proofs on the natural numbers, and this is a proof of this kind, I have to show that the claim holds in the base case, so for zero, and I have to show that if it holds for some natural number, then it holds for the successor of that natural number. And then it will give me that it holds for all natural numbers by basically starting at zero, and then because it holds for zero, it holds for one, because it holds for one, it holds for two, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I start off by showing that the identity law that I see there holds for zero, meaning that when I plug zero in on both sides, I get the same thing. Well, start on the right-hand side. So the right-hand side is fold n of 0 and suck, and I apply it to 0. Well, this is according to the recursive definition of fold n. So what I get is this thing here, so which again happens to be 0, which is also identity of 0. So that part was easy. So the other case is that I have the successor of some natural number n for which the claim is already assumed to be true. So for n, we already know this thing holds. Okay, so we just expand the recursive definition of fold n. So that's, well, this function here applied to the result of applying fold n of 0 and suck to n, right? So this is suck of fold n 0 suck applied to n. Now the inductive hypothesis kicks in. I already know that this thing here equals identity of n. And of course, identity of n is n. And this, of course, is identity of suck n. So there's, I've been very fastidious about the occurrences of identity here. This is partly in order to make this equation here visible, right? So the identity has the property of this k that appears later in the fusion law, right? So the identity in this case commutes through these functions that I have on either, well, on either side. Well, if there were two sides, I mean, in this case, there is only one because the thing that I'm looking at is identity, right? But so basically the law that partly makes this work, although a very trivial instance of it, is the same as in the fusion law. And actually the same thing happens here, right? So identity also maps 0 to 0, right? So here we also have a law that is very much analogous to the requirements on K that we see in the fusion law. Okay, and we'll just manage the fusion law. So I'll do this more briefly, in particular, skip over the composition thing again. So K of fold n ch applied to 0 Well, this here just gives me C, so this is K of C. And by assumption, this is C prime. And of course, C prime is just fold n of C prime h prime applied to 0. So for the base case, it works. Okay, so the other case is the successor case, so suck of n, as the argument. Okay. Again, I just apply the definition of fold n. So what I get is k of h of fold n ch of n. Okay, here I have k of h of something. Now I apply my assumption that I can commute k through h and turn it into h prime. So this here equals h prime of k of fold n ch applied to n. Now the inductive hypothesis kicks in. This here, k of fold n ch of n is something about which we already know the claim to be true, or assume the claim to be true. So this is h prime of fold n c prime h prime applied to n. And this is just the definition of fold n c prime h prime applied to sac of n. So I've shown what I have to show. So here, let's mark this. This here is where the inductive hypothesis is used. I'll mark this here as well. Okay, that would be it for today. Any questions? Right, so have a nice weekend and see you on Monday.